Hello, I'm Nicholas Barrett.
I'm Maria Demirtis.
I'm Gontran Wolf.
And you're listening to The Sound of Economics.
My government's priority is to deliver the United Kingdom's departure from the European Union on the 31st of January.
And Brexit is finally upon us. But regular listeners will know that Brexit doesn't mean Brexit, at least not this week, because while Britain is walking away from the European institutions, it will still be staying within the EU's regulatory orbit for at least another 11 months.
What everybody wants to do is put Brexit behind us on January the 31st, then move on. And there's a lot of goodwill, a lot of energy now about building the new deep and special partnership, and that's what we're going to do.
So Michael Lee is Academic Director in European Public Policy at Johns Hopkins University. He's also worked as the EU's chief enlargement negotiator. Today he joins us to discuss his simulated negotiations on a post-Brexit agreement for research and development, which we will discuss later in the podcast, but not before we find out what Michael thinks about the year ahead. Michael, if Britain isn't at the EU table, does that mean it's on the menu?
Well, it is on the menu to a very considerable extent. And even if the member states would prefer it were otherwise, I think Brexit is going to be popping up in many discussions, whether on trade, security and defence, finance, multilateral financial framework. It's hard to get away from it.
How much do you expect to be achieved in 11 months?
11 months is short.
I know that this negotiation will be difficult and demanding. For one reason, the time will be extremely short.
I've been involved in many negotiations, accession negotiations, but I've also followed closely trade negotiations. We know how long it took to conclude a fairly modest free trade agreement with Canada and other partners. This is a multi-annual effort in general. Britain is already a member. It's already aligned. It believes it will be able to draw on the existing acquis of its relations to shorten the period needed, but 11 months is an awfully short period.
Now, Maria, you've been working on this week, and you think Britain might have a little bit more leverage than a lot of people think.
Yeah, well, there's a big story here. First, I think if I may start from the point that Michael said about the duration, 11 months is a bit short, and it's particularly short because it is likely that national parliaments will have to be involved in approving whatever is negotiated. There's technicalities behind this, but I think the likelihood is that national parliaments will have to be involved. For this to happen, it means that they need to be presented with something a lot earlier than that. So effectively, we have zero time to sort of start negotiations. That concentrates the mind wonderfully, in my view. When you have little time to negotiate, maybe it is you should go where you think there are fruits to be had.
Without an extension of the transition period beyond 2020, you cannot expect to agree on every single aspect of our new partnership. We will have to prioritize.
And this is where I think there are things that we can discuss. I think the single market, access to the single market, is something that the EU is going to demand and has the power to demand. But on financial services, and perhaps we can come back to that, maybe the EU has something to gain with the UK diverting.
Gundrum, a lot of the talk will be along alignment, and that's already been discussed heavily in the last 2 weeks in British politics. But do you think that will become less of a red line once Brexit, in inverted commas, has actually happened on Friday?
Well, the UK, as it leaves the EU, is fully aligned with the European Union. However, it wants to diverge in regulatory terms. And if there is any point in Brexit, it has to be about regaining autonomy on regulation and doing your own regulation and doing it differently to what the EU is doing. So if that is to happen, and I think it will happen, I don't think the UK will, in the long term, be fully aligned on all the dimensions with the EU, because then it would be a pure rules taker, which is not acceptable for a big country with such an important financial center. And Mark Carney, for example, the governor of the Bank of England, has warned against that option. To be a rules taker is not acceptable for a big financial center like the UK, like the City of London. So if that happens, if we see the regulatory divergence, we have to find mechanisms or how to deal with future regulatory divergence. And I think there the key is dispute settlement. It's regulatory mediation. So how do you deal with this and how do you agree on disputes? And dispute settlement is intrinsically difficult and politically very complicated. And as Maria pointed out, it's actually very difficult to get it through the EU legislative process because it requires essentially the agreement of national parliaments.
Michael, when you think about the year ahead, what strikes you as a kind of mutually beneficial deal that is realistic and achievable?
What's realistic and achievable is probably a limited agreement on free trade in goods that might eliminate tariffs and quotas, but that would not be able to go very deep into this question of regulatory alignment. I could also imagine a parallel agreement or statement which set out the areas for cooperation, drawing on the existing political declaration, but it will be very hard to go into detail on those and to reach the kind of agreement that we have done, for example, in our exercise here at Bruegel over the last few months on science and research. Time is simply too short for the complexity of the issues involved. And then, of course, there's also the question of political will.
If I may take up on that, I mean, I'm beginning actually to sympathize with the argument that the most likely outcome may be it's a very narrow trade agreement. But let's just think a little bit about that, right? I mean, it's very easy in my view to think of financial agreements being done in a good way. The EU needs the City of London. So on the finance side, I think there will be an agreement that could be mutually beneficial for the London and for the EU the same. When it comes to trade, if there is only a narrow agreement, it means that economically it's not going to be a very good thing. So here we are. We are Brexit 5 years from now. We have the City of London developing even more than now, simply because it will have the power to do so. And on trade, what happens on trade? Well, there will be good outcomes for the UK, so more polarization in the UK. I think that's a very unfortunate outcome, actually. If it does happen this way, we don't manage to get a good trade deal because it happens in very short time with the interest of simply satisfying political gains, then the UK is simply going to see more inequality, not less.
What will ordinary people feel in such a scenario?
Absolutely, because the trade, manufacturing will suffer. All the things that are affected by trade, simply because the deal is not good enough, then they are the ones who will suffer from it. Bad trade deals will lead to bad outcomes. If that is true, and unfortunately may be likely, then what you will do is the City of London will prosper, simply because we will manage to agree on something. On the trade, well, the rest of the UK will suffer.
Can you give me an example of a bad trade deal?
Well, manufacturing. I mean, if we don't have a good agreement on manufacturing, what will UK manufacturing do?
No, but from the past, something that went wrong and had bad effects for both.
No, what I'm saying is if you don't have free trade, frictionless trade between the UK and the EU will benefit because it's a bigger player. All the foreign companies, the third countries, will come to the EU, and the UK will lose the Nissans of this world, will lose the car industry. Car industry is an interesting one.
We will also lose a market, it seems to me. I mean, we will lose a market, and we are on goods, we are in surplus with the UK. So I mean, I think the key question is indeed the financial side. And I think this view that we need the City of London, I think it's actually quite a controversial view. And many people have a very different view on this, especially parliamentarians, that tend to think basically we have a very well-developed financial system, banking system in the EU, and therefore do not need the city of London. Our banking system is flushed with liquidity. So what's the point of adding a few additional derivative markets? And I think we should be very careful. I mean, even post-Brexit, even if there's no passporting, the City of London doesn't disappear. And those financial firms that need specific solutions from London, they can still go to London as they do currently go to New York, for example. So I think a lot depends on what kind of equivalence will be given and how much. And I think the EU will be at most ready to give short-term equivalent status to the City of London for a short period of time. And use and really try to, as EU institutions, really try to push the development of the European financial system, the European capital markets, is the key point. But if I may, I think our exercise on the science and research collaboration is actually also quite telling in terms of how complex and how many issues are out there. And I think it would be very interesting to hear a bit more about the simulation in a game that Sir Michael has actually led. So
it was a very interesting exercise that involved scientists, researchers, policy people, former member of the European Parliament, science policy experts, who formed two teams, a UK team and an EU team, who set themselves the goal of negotiating an agreement for the association of the UK with the EU's future framework program on research and innovation, Horizon Europe. And the main takeaway from the experience was that with the necessary political will and effort, such an agreement is feasible. And even though there are half a dozen very tricky areas, beginning with the UK's financial contribution, but also the decision-making structure, the dispute settlement structure, the question of alignment of standards, laboratory standards, safety standards, and so on, compromise solutions were found. The challenge is to see whether this positive experience can be reproduced in the real world.
So this wasn't just people sitting behind computers writing documents about what might happen when these negotiations happen. This was actually a mock negotiation with people going back and forth between them with different ideas. But did anything surprise you?
It surprised me how quickly the two sides were able to identify the most difficult issues and how willing they were, in light of what is at stake, to find compromise solutions. In fact, as the facilitator, at times I felt my main task was to inject an element of controversy into the discussion to prevent these scientists having a love-in and reaching an agreement in the first round. And the issues were thorny, and they did need more time. But they were able to overcome many of the difficulties, for example, on dispute settlement. In principle, the UK has a red line about not accepting the European Court of Justice as the arbiter in the event of disputes. But in our exercise, the participants on both sides noted that until now, there has never been a case that's been up to the European Court of Justice under the framework programs. So under those circumstances, our UK team decided to be pragmatic and accept the European Court of Justice as the arbiter. Now, in the real world, it might not go quite that smoothly.
Exactly. Sorry, I didn't mean to interfere.
Oh, sorry. For those who don't know, because obviously a lot of our listeners are in America and maybe not all of them are that attuned to European affairs, what is Horizon 2020 and why is it so important?
The EU has had a series of major programs known here as framework programs to finance research and innovation involving teams from institutions in the different member states. And the focus for our discussion was the new framework program that's going to begin in January next year, and that is tentatively budgeted at 100 billion euros for the period between 2021 and 2027. And under this program, there will be bids by researchers, institutions, laboratories, universities for grants in a range of priority research areas, from cancer treatment through to clean energy, other environmental issues, and all those questions that are top of our agenda today.
And if I can just emphasize this point on the dispute that was part of this negotiation and relate this also to our regulatory divergence discussion. I mean, one of the points that became very clear that even in this narrow field of research where we talk about research collaboration per year, it's 10 billion, 15 billion. So it's not a huge amount of money. But even in that field, there is, of course, the need to come to clear rules, how to deal with things. I mean, there's rules concerning the financial framework itself. What if the two parties disagree on how a certain financial settlement should be settled? Well, where could they turn to at the limit? And that was an astonishing result, showing that the researchers clearly had a preference for a deal. Well, at the limit, they accept the ECJ, I mean, the European Court of Justice. But then there's, well beyond this, there immediately come questions of sovereignty that were very touchy on the UK side. What if the participation in a joint research program implies that you have to adhere to certain standards as regards animal welfare in clinical trials. I mean, just to give a very concrete example, which animal welfare will be applied? Will it be the UK animal welfare standards, or will it be the EU ones if it is a jointly funded project with both sides, universities from both sides actually participating? So who's going to decide on these rules? It sounds very technical, but somehow before starting such a program, one has to find agreement on how this would actually be operated.
You also see sovereignty issues at stake on decision-making. First of all, decision-making about the overall orientations of the program, and then on issues arising under the program. And at the start of the exercise, the UK was going in there with guns blazing, demanding a right to vote in the key committees that will take the important decisions. And then as the discussions went on, and the two sides agreed to set up a joint committee between the UK and the EU to take decisions on important matters in the future, our UK team came to the view that in practice, decisions in this area tend to be taken by consensus. And it simply wasn't worth it to them to bust up the negotiations by insisting on the right to vote. Once again, in the real world, let's wait and see. Mm-hmm. Because we're confronting here the rationality of a sector and the desire of practitioners on both sides to maintain the benefits, not to them personally, but to the sectors, the spin-off benefits to the economy and to the population of cooperation in this field. They're very reluctant to let go of it, and they're looking for compromise solutions. As we saw in our debate in Bruegel, in reality, real-life politics is likely to intrude. And however rational from a sectoral point of view it might be to reach an early agreement in this field, it's going to get caught up in the broader negotiations.
Go ahead.
And I was just going to say that, I mean, this is a sector that was very much pro-Remain before this project started. So I'm actually very happy it's confirmed its beliefs that this was... They were very... You know, sad to see the EU, and they're very quick to try and make a deal in terms of getting good outcomes. That makes a lot of sense to me, but that's not where the difficulties will be. It will not be in sectors that are sensible when it comes to these types of issues. I think it will come in sectors where there is antagonism, and that where before the referendum there was a lot of discomfort with EU rules. I think this is where the whole things will lead to perhaps a very narrow trade deal by the end of the year.
I think that this is sort of one of the key questions is about the structure of the negotiation now going forward, right? I mean, so I think obviously the EU at this stage has decided to pool its negotiation continue to be pooled in one team, the team of Michel Barnier. And that has implications for, getting a package deal. Now, the reality may be that we end up with a narrow trade deal, and I actually think it's probably it's a significant likelihood that we have a narrow trade deal in these next 11 months. And then afterwards, people will start negotiating on a much more sectoral basis. And there, you know, I think the purpose's package nature might be gone, and that could lead to very different outcomes because I think, as you highlighted, the interests of specific groups on different topics is very different. And the challenge from an EU point of view is to really keep as much as possible all the strands together to increase its leverage and its negotiating power. But I think the logic of the different interests of the member states of the EU will be increasingly look at these sectoral agreements and deal with them more separately because particular interests are really at stake. And so the unity that we've had on the EU side in the Brexit negotiation was very much a unity also that was driven by the fact that we all had the same interest, protect the single market and make sure the UK pays. Going forward, we all don't fully have the same interest because it's such a complex field in such complex different areas of negotiations.
In our simulated negotiation, there were trade-offs But there were trade-offs between issues within the broad field of science and research. And we were rather pleased that we could do a mini package deal in this area. But again, in the real world, there'll be linkages made between this field and many others. And also, the arguments that seemed so clear to our participants to give priority to this field because of the obvious benefits, if you're in aeronautics, if you are in the fisheries business, or almost any other key sector of the economy, you're going to be convinced that your sector is a priority too. So in truth, we're likely to move towards some kind of macro rather than mini package deal in the future.
I think it's fair to say that, at least on this podcast, we tend to err towards a general aspiration towards integration. But did anything come out of these negotiations that was a net benefit for UK research and development, something good that they didn't have before because they left the European Union?
I think there are those in the UK who believe that once the UK is free of the shackles of EU regulation, they will be free to conclude agreements around the world.
From January the 31st, what we're going to do is start working with our friends and partners around the world, not just with the EU.
And that this might provide a stimulus to cooperation with researchers, whether in North America or in the Commonwealth, in Asia, etc. Of course, there has been no obstacle to that taking place until now. So it's not immediately clear how obstacles in cooperation with the EU would spark new cooperation with countries around the world. But there are those who believe that this could be the effect.
Could you?
Well, perhaps one other dimension to your question is, again, regulation. I think, obviously, it seems to me that it's not an attractive option for the UK to deregulate its economy and become Singapore and Thames, as the saying goes. Because, of course, the UK has labor standards and wants to protect its domestic population. Having said that, there is scope to come to different regulatory outcomes and regulatory outcomes that are perhaps more quickly reached than in the EU because the decision-making process might be easier. And perhaps that on some dimensions might be actually more innovation-friendly, more business-friendly, and so on. I mean, take artificial intelligence, take data protection. Well, it's actually thinkable and conceivable that the way the UK will deal with data protection and artificial intelligence will be more innovation-friendly than the way the EU will regulate it. And that will then also, coming back to the science and research collaboration, cause frictions because we will have two different sets of standards on these issues. And how do you deal with this when you want to do joint research? So I think there are, I mean, especially on this regulatory field, in the report, we also highlight that the UK side and the UK negotiators were very much insisting on the fact, well, we want some regulatory freedom so that we can regulate our science somehow differently if we want to.
There may be a learning curve on this after Brexit. I think before Brexit, for the main proponents of Brexit, this has been a matter of principle. And it's been one of the arguments to show that there will be concrete benefits from leaving the European Union. Now, once they have left, if they maintain the goal of seamless trade, this is the expression that's used again and again, they will discover rather quickly that this does not depend only on abolishing tariffs and quotas, and that there are a myriad of services involved in production and trading goods. This becomes clear. And I strongly suspect that this absolute commitment to divergence is likely to be watered down in practice when the real consequences are better understood.
I just wanted to say that, I mean, coming back to your question whether there's anything good here for the UK, I mean, I suppose there is value in having the freedom to choose which way to go. I think that's a good thing. I mean, and the UK actually has acted upon that, right? But whether this freedom leads to better economic outcomes, that remains to be seen. But I mean, you know, the very fact that you have the opportunity to choose for yourself which way you want to go, and, you know, and exploit benefits where they are, you know, it's a good thing. And I mean, you know, that in, a priori at least, on the principles based, is a choice now that the UK has that other countries in the EU do not, because they have, by definition, to ally with laws.
It would be quite a vindication of the European project if Britain had this kind of wonderful version of freedom, but every path of that's pragmatic and every path of least resistant kind of falls into the gravitational pull of the European economy. And you maybe, perhaps it takes a decade or so, but you basically get back to where you started.
I wouldn't call that a vindication, though. A vindication? I mean, the EU should not aim for the UK to do badly. I think that's a very bad thing for the UK and a very bad thing for the EU. It's unfortunate that the UK is trying to do that, at least from my perspective. And to aim for the UK to do bad is not a good idea, in my view.
Well, there are lots of forces around the world, perhaps in Moscow and Washington, that would perhaps quite like to undermine the European Union and see Brexit as a way of doing that. So it's just another part of that, I suppose. So I guess on final thoughts, I'm just going to go around the table and ask what the chances are, maybe in percentage terms, of finishing a trade deal by December 31st.
13%.
13. Michael?
13. I think there's 25% chance of reaching a limited trade agreement.
I think there is a 50% chance of reaching a narrow trade agreement on goods.
I think there'll definitely be something. Anyway, Guntram and Maria, thank you very much for joining us. And special thank you to you, Sir Michael Lee. It's always nice to have you here. And you can read the report on innovation after Brexit at the Bruegel website and on the Wellcome Trust website, who collaborated in this project. And thank you very much for listening. Goodbye. Thank you for listening to The Sound of Economics. This podcast was presented by me, Nicholas Barrett, and edited by Tiago Almeida, and brought to you by the Bruegel think tank in Brussels. To read our papers and blogs, you can visit bruegel.org, and if you enjoyed this podcast, you can subscribe on Spotify and iTunes, where you can also leave us a review and let other people know that we exist. And you can stay up to date with everything we do by following us on Twitter, @bruegel_org. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.